This summer, fascist rioters spread terror on the streets of the UK. It was the appalling culmination of years of incendiary hate and racism. In this podcast, we discuss what anti-racism campaigners are doing to confront and turn back the wave of hate.
To the UK next, where several police officers have been injured trying to separate anti-immigrant rioters from counter-protesters in the city of Plymouth. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has said he would be deploying, quote, a standing army of police officers as violent riots threaten to stretch into a second week. More than 370 people have been arrested in connection with the unrest so far, which followed the fatal stabbings of three young girls in the town of Southport.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. Our guest on today's show is Shyster Aziz, a long-standing member of the Another Europe is Possible family and a big friend of the show. Shyster is a co-director of the anti-racist campaign platform Three Hijabis and has many years of experience as an anti-racist activist and was also for a long time until quite recently a councillor on Oxford City Council. We talked to Shyster about the horrifying attacks we've seen in our communities and the enabling role played by mainstream Islamophobia.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anotheureup.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Shyster, it's great to have you back on the show. I'm so sorry that we're having to talk about this topic, to be honest, and respond to this terrible wave of far-right violence that we've seen this summer. It must have just taken on a personal level a huge mental toll dealing with all of this, right?
Yeah. Hi there, Luke. I just want to start, first of all, by thanking you for inviting me onto the podcast. And I think it's really important that we have more and more spaces where we can actually really talk about Islamophobia in particular, but talk about racism and the rise of the far right in our country and across Europe. And, you know, consistently Another Europe is Possible has really been that space on the left, because sadly, I don't think that many of those spaces exist. And I also want to thank you personally for checking in on me and being a, you know, a real source of support. I think this is something that we need to see more of, particularly from white men, but also white people in general. Many people probably struggle to know what to say. So I just want to start by thanking you as well and all the team at Another Europe is Possible.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, obviously. And it's not always easy to know what to say, to be honest. It's okay to not know what to say and to still try and find a way to check in. I guess lots of listeners will have found themselves in this situation. What do you say when your friends' communities are being terrorized in the way that they have been? It's really hard to find those words to check in with people and to contact your friends and ask them what's going on and show and try and be there for them, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm glad we're starting from this point, because I think this is a really important point, isn't it? So I think for me, the point here is that, okay, we know that certain groups in our country are under attack again. I don't think it's new that we're under attack. However, under attack in different ways. And actually, all of us are under attack. If we really believe in decency and humanity, then all of us are under attack. So if I'm not safe as a Muslim woman who wears a headscarf or hijab, then I know my Jewish sisters aren't safe. I know my Jewish brothers aren't safe. I know the people I care about are not safe, including, you know, trans people I know. So I think this is the bigger picture. The bigger picture is that often we struggle to know what to say. And as you say, I think it's really okay. And I think it's really important for us to know that it's okay to struggle with these things, because these are big, horrific things. However, some of us don't have the privilege to switch off. And I think that needs to be acknowledged as well. So I think reaching out and showing solidarity and making sure, checking in with people who are going to be additionally vulnerable at this time is really, really important.
Yeah, thank you so much again for saying that. And looking back, it's been a few weeks now on these riots. Let's talk through some of the factors that drove this.
Yeah, so like all decent-minded people, whatever you're, you know, whoever you are, I was horrified by what unfolded a few weeks ago. If you said to me, you know, was I surprised? The answer is absolutely not. There's a big build-up to this. Many decades have led to where we are. I think the fact that it happened at such speed and the way that the disinformation in particular spread really fast, like wildfire online in particular, but, you know, the kind of the different forces at work. So the privileged, the elite, those with a lot of money and those running social media platforms and well-known politicians who've fanned the flames of bigotry for years and misinformation, all of that coming together in such a horrific way, it was really shocking to see and it was frightening. So I don't live in a part of the country where there were mosques under attack or home office hotels housing migrants and refugees under attack. And I do live in a city where one of our refugee organisations was named on a Telegram chat, which was purportedly a far-right chat saying that they would be attacking them. So people did mobilise in the city I'm in, which is Oxford. I also have a lot of family in the north of England, and even me, with all my agency and all my independence and everything I've done with my life, I found myself not wanting to leave my house, not wanting to go out, feeling very, very anxious and nervous about my mum in particular, who is an older woman, who's a very feisty woman, I'd like to add, and doesn't tolerate nonsense. But she's, you know, not been in good health and she's vulnerable. So, you know, lots of discussions going on in family WhatsApp groups, family members trying to make sure each other's safe and giving each other advice. So these are the realities. And, you know, these realities don't just happen when the far right are on the rise in this country and literally orchestrating violence on the streets, racist, Islamophobic, anti-refugee migrant violence. It happens a lot. It happens when there's something going on in the world, when there's, you know, an attack in a Western country, a terrorist incident. These things happen. We have to start checking in with each other as British Muslims because we know that very sadly we end up being scapegoated. So I think from a personal point of view, this has been a very challenging time for pretty much most of my family in this country, at least, and family who aren't in this country have been checking and asking what is going on in the UK, what is happening to Britain. So there's been a lot of shock.
I was going to throw into the mix, I don't often praise the BBC on the Another Europe podcast, but they did do an excellent piece of investigative journalism that I was quite fascinated and actually surprised by. I know there's a lot of this that doesn't sadly surprise us, but this particular factoid did surprise me. And they identified one of the main sites that were spreading disinformation about the killings in Southport at the very outset of the crisis. And I had assumed, and I think this is perfectly plausible assumption, right, that it was like a far right website. And they did come in afterwards, the far-right disinformation websites, to project it. But this website actually just existed to make money. One of the guys that set up this website is based in Pakistan. Another guy was based in Latin America. And they had basically worked out that the changes that Elon Musk had created on Twitter, and it's in using sort of algorithmic, in a projection of information through networks, that the more shares you get, the more money you make on their website and stuff like this. There were ways to hack that with the most sensational, outrageous stories possible, get lots of traffic to your website and bank the advertising revenue from that, and you go on to the next disinformation story. And it was kind of, it feels a bit totemic, really, in the relationship between sort of money and far right and the role that Twitter has played. So I think behind this whole story is obviously this figure of Elon Musk and the changes that he's done as this old big billionaire. But then there are these sort of other networks of money-making disinformation that are circulating in the information space. And it sort of feels like a bit of a contagion where lots of different factors intersect with one another to make it worse. Does that make sense? And do you feel that this sort of spiral happening?
Well, I think it's been happening for a long time. I think the way that it manifested in terms of the violence that we saw on the streets took on another level. We have witnessed this, for example, when Capitol was stormed in Washington. A lot of that was through disinformation as well. But yeah, you're right. There's like an ecosystem of disinformation, and it's very much about making money, and it's very monetarized. And let's not also forget that mainstream media is part of this as well. So the clickbait industry, the headlines that are often generated that are really inflammatory and horrendous. And this has been going on for years. So if we focus just on the last 25 years alone, so next month, in September the 11th, the anniversary, 25 years, I believe it is, from 9/11. And just in that time alone, if we didn't want to go back any further than that, if we just use that as a framework, as a reference point, you know, the daily hysterical coverage about Muslims in particular, but also about refugees and migrants and anyone who's other, and most recently it's been about trans people, all of this feeds into this nexus. And it's really horrifying how it's become bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, we're all consuming it, even if we don't want to, you can't avoid it. And it's very much part of our mainstream media landscape. This isn't just some shadowy outlets, you know, in some kind of dubious part of the world with a server that they're using to spew hatred. This is part of our mainstream media landscape. And you've got these extremist right-wing so-called inverted commas pundits who are given more and more airtime, and their voices and they call them politics as hateful ideologies have been very normalized. And so I think we have to really ask, how has this happened? And it's happened because people want to believe this stuff. When I say people, I don't necessarily mean everyday people on, you know, who live in this country, but those who run the media industry, those who are loud voices and voices that influence, they have really allowed this to get out of control, and they should be held to account. And indeed, there has been movements, hasn't there, over the last few years to try and stop companies and advertisers from giving money to news organizations, radio stations and others who continue to put out stories that are factually inaccurate and that are designed to stoke up hatred. Obviously, they're going to deny this, but that's what it does. And, you know, the former prime minister of this country, Boris Johnson, no less, you know, once when he was a so-called journalist working for The Telegraph and others, you know, there's plenty of evidence out there that shows that he literally made stories up about the EU in particular, decades of demonizing the EU. Now, there's many reasons why the EU needs to be called out for its policies, particular migration and things like that. What we're looking for, though, is accuracy in the critique, and it's been missing. And I think so we've got to a point now where commentary and facts are blurred. And this is how I think we have ended up where we are. But we've also ended up where we are because of politicians in mainstream politics that have really allowed the ideologies of the far right to become part of mainstream British policy, particularly on immigration and migration. But also this horrific kind of framing of social cohesion and British values. I mean, I'm British and I have no idea what British values are. I keep being told by politicians that, you know, we need to have British values. But when you ask those politicians, well, what are those values? They kind of can't even really explain what they are. So if you put all of this together over 25 years of blatant, aggressive Islamophobia, anti-migrant commentary and stories and everything else, the inevitable outcome is what we saw on the streets, which was the far right. Even now, some people don't want to call them the far right. They say that these are working class white people who have legitimate concerns. Now, many working class people, and obviously the working class are multiracial and long may that continue, have legitimate concerns. But they're not on the streets attacking the police, attacking hotels, housing migrants and refugees, setting fire to hotels, putting bricks through mosque windows, threatening imams, threatening everyday British people. That's not happening. So I think even now there's this sort of desire to kind of pretend what we saw happen over the last few weeks and the way it manifested is not real.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot there. And I just wanted to zone in for a moment on, if you like, the proper extreme right that have been involved in this. I'm thinking in particular Tommy Robinson. I don't know if he's directly kind of implicated, but I think he's part of the same ecosystem. Andrew Tate, from a like this hardline misogynist. I'm wondering if, in response to this crisis, one of the silver linings is that there is at least now a serious public discussion around no platform again, and actually looking at getting these guys, and they are guys, off the platforms. Do you sense that there's like a proper discussion around that as well? And I know this has become complicated in a way for all the reasons that you've described and we've emphasized on this podcast for a long time. It's the mainstreaming of far-right politics. But it seems to me there was something like distinctly fascist about like hardcore fascist street violence, and that should be criminalized. It should be kicked off social media. And it's not easy to work out exactly. It's a blurry line between when you transition from that to, say, Reform and Nigel Farage, who will often make it even more blurry by saying something positive about Tommy Robinson or whatever. And then you've got all of this legitimate concerns discourse. So do you think that sort of no platform is back, like this, the idea that, look, we actually should be able to take decisions about who can have access to platforms and who can't, and some people just have to be considered beyond the pale?
So I think the first thing here is that if we had proper accountability and transparency in our mainstream media when it comes to interviewing the type of figures that you named, we wouldn't have to even think about no platforming. So, for example, a journalist is interviewing the named leader of a far-right organization. That is exactly how they should be described. What I've heard over the last few years is the likes of Tommy Robinson being described as right-wing activists. I've heard that. I've heard that from mainstream journalists, and I've actually written to them and asked them, what are you talking about? How can you be describing this individual as a right-wing activist when they're the named, designated person, the leader of a far-right organization? So, you know, the way all of this has also been blurred is horrifying. And this is the first thing. I think there needs to be proper accountability. Obviously, there are laws and there are mechanisms in this country to ensure the press is regulated. Those same laws and rules need to be applied to social media. Social media platforms claim they're not media companies. I think it's very hard for them to really say that with a straight face. They are very much, they function like media companies. So they should definitely be made to operate under the same rules. I think that no platforming can become difficult and challenging if you also advocate free speech. However, there's a very big difference between advocating free speech and having fascists sprouting fascism on the airwaves. And again, I think one of the challenges in the country, in the UK, is how all of this has been completely blurred and, you know, there's this disingenuous way of framing all of this and talking about all of this. And that's what's created this situation that we're in as well. And obviously, there's a lot of money to be made around having these kind of odious and dangerous far-right and racist views. And people know that. So, you know, there's lots of information that's been published about the alleged salary of Nigel Farage, who, alongside being a member of the parliament, is also moonlighting as a TV presenter on a right-wing channel. And apparently he's making more than £92,000 a week, which is quite an extraordinary situation.
A month.
Yeah, a month, I should say. All of these things have kind of made the situation much worse. So I'm not sure if I believe in no platforming, if I'm honest with you. I do think, though, like I said, that people should be described as what they are. So we've got a situation now where in our mainstream media, if somebody comes onto a television program or a radio program and they're adamant that there's a tornado outside, they can be as adamant as they want. The job of the presenter and the producers and everybody else is to look out the window. Is there a tornado outside? No, in which case, tell the person there is no tornado outside. This is not true. This is just not true. Take them on and expose them for what they are.
Yeah, really, really interesting and really, really nuanced like discussion in all of this. I mean, you must have also, if we're always trying to find positives on this show, not easy on this topic, but, you know, the community response, the mobilization in response to these riots was really inspiring and brave in many cases. A friend of mine was involved in mobilizing a really big demonstration, anti-racist demonstration in Newcastle in response to all of this. And yeah, he sort of conveyed that sense of pride to me and how the community had actually responded in a really sort of careful, well-organized way to ensure the security and protection of the community, and also in a way that ensured discipline in the response as well, mindful of, you know, the danger of really bad optics that could be manipulated and instrumentalized by the people who are inciting this violence. And it was a really sort of positive, progressive response in the city to what had happened. You must feel that as well, that this is a kind of moment of opportunity for anti-racism as much as in terror of it all as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. There has been lots of beautiful solidarity and active anti-racism we have witnessed over the last few weeks in particular. And I think the first wave of it was actually from the communities who were under siege themselves. So specifically, I'm talking about British Muslims who went out to protect the mosques, who created groups of people to be vigilant, but also explained to them that we don't want you on the streets fighting these people. We don't want you fighting the police. We don't want any of that. Very much tied into what you've said already. And I think it's really important for that to be acknowledged, that many people from all different backgrounds came out. And the first wave who came out were people from the communities themselves who were under siege. And I think that's really important to acknowledge. And then the wider movement as well, you know, it's powerful and incredible to see 20,000 people, 10,000 people out on the streets standing in solidarity with each other, making it very clear that this is not acceptable and we will not allow fascists on our streets. We will not allow them to cause havoc in our communities, to terrify people, to try and attack mosques, to try and attack refugees and migrants. And that was really powerful and beautiful and really needed. And it's not enough. We cannot have these one-off moments where people take to the streets. I think we need to have a continuous movement. And it's really complicated again, because there's been really powerful moments when the left has really come together. And I also know that the left has been targeted and has come under attack. You know, the draconian legislation that's been passed around protests. If you look at what's happening to climate crisis campaigners and those who take direct action in particular, it's horrifying to see, you know, the way that they've been locked up for 5 years or for long sentences for basically doing the right things. There's a lot at stake here as well. But I think one of the things that's really at stake right now is what next? So what is the response from the left, and who exactly are the left? I think we have to drill down and ask these questions. And I think one of the things we do need to do is to build broad, plural anti-racism movement that is really aligned with communities. So it needs to be at a local level, and it needs to be based on what people in the neighborhoods are under attack. What do they want? Not about what anti-racist campaigners think they want, but what is it that people want? We need to make sure that more resource is given to those activists on the ground as well. So traditionally, the Labour Party in particular, the trade unions have funded the Labour Party, and the Labour Party has been synonymous with trade unions, but not enough resource is made available to grassroots communities and, you know, people of colour in particular. We've not been almost allowed, inverted commas, to develop these anti-racism movements because the resource is not available. So I think all of these things need to be talked about. We need to have lots of discussions which lead to action at different levels. So at the top, we need to ask trade unions, well, actually, what are you really doing to mobilize anti-racism in this country, and how are you going about it, and who are you speaking to, and are you opening the gates, or are you being gatekeepers to having resource available to communities so they can develop their own campaigns? They know how to speak and listen to people they live with every day, people they work with every day. And then the broader anti-racism movement, I think, needs to be far more diverse than it currently is. I actually wrote a piece for Al Jazeera on the 9th of August. So it was the day after there was a mass mobilization of anti-racists on the streets of our country. And the headline is "Anti-Racists Save Britain. Now it's time for Keir Starmer to take action." And I do think that that headline is fully accurate. And at the same time, I do think that it's not just Keir Starmer who needs to take action. It's also, like I said, the trade unions, other parts of the, you know, socialist apparatus in our country that needs to understand that things have really changed in the last few weeks. They've been changing a lot every week, every month, and now no one can deny this. There's a new threat in a way that we've not seen before. And so we cannot keep doing the same old. We need to do things differently. And I think the main thing that needs to change is, as I keep saying, we need to see those communities, particularly in the north of England, being listened to by the left. And we need a resource, particularly funding, you know, things like access to community centres have to be paid for. Austerity, I know we're going to talk about that in a bit, has really gutted communities. The infrastructure for community mobilization has been dismantled over 14, 15 years in particular. So there's a lot of things that we need to change, and the change has to come from us as the left and as a movement of people.
Yeah, well, let's talk about austerity for a moment in that context of the role that it's playing in the strategy and in the resistance and getting resources into communities. You know, I wanted to ask you what role you think austerity played in all of this, the fascist riots themselves, because there was, like all riots, a kind of element of desperation. You see this in some of the court cases, and I'm not for a minute, of course, justifying the horrendous things that they did. But there was this sense of desperation. I mean, some of it was quite comic, you see, from the, I mean, if it can be comic, you see from some of the court cases that people went into the town to pick up a takeaway and somehow got drawn into a riot, that there's this sort of desperate moment in a riot, crowd mentality form and stuff like this. But it's not always the easiest thing to talk about, because obviously communities of colour, the working class as a whole in all of its diversity, have been at the sharp end of austerity. The fact of austerity doesn't for a moment legitimise any of this appalling white nationalist sort of fascist politics and ecosystems. But it does appear to be a factor. If you look at some of the places where these riots happened, you know, Sunderland has a hell of a lot of poverty. I spend quite a lot of time in the northeast, that it is, has this, yeah, desperation to it. You're, I think, really good and experienced, actually, in your role as a councillor previously, in having difficult conversations, because these people who talk about legitimate concerns and everything, they always talk about, well, what the, shouldn't the legitimate concern be here? Desperate inequality, appalling poverty. Those are the actual legitimate concerns, like the failures of 40 years of neoliberalism and deindustrialization and the impact that that has had on communities. It's not whether, you know, 150 asylum seekers in the local area are properly housed so that their claims for refugee status can be processed. That's just human rights. Opposition to that isn't legitimate.
I think you're right. The level of inequality is the fact that there's a massive divide between the north and south. So, you know, I'm like you, I'm a peculiar southerner that spends a lot of time in the north of the country. And I've lived in Preston and in Manchester for a number of years. And I also have family dotted around the north of England. So Bradford, Burnley, Blackburn, and other places. And so I'm been travelling to the north of England since I was a kid, and I have some understanding of the day-to-day reality because my family lived there. And, you know, it's a devastating divide. It's a really shocking and horrifying divide. I mean, I was actually up in the north of England visiting my family in the places I've just mentioned to you about 4 or 5 weeks ago, so very, very recently. I was still stunned by the deprivation in some of the towns. And I've always been stunned by the difference between what life is like here in the South. I'm not saying, you know, there's no poverty in the South, just to be clear, but there's a very sharp difference between the North and the South. And despite all the talk of so-called leveling up and everything else, nothing has really changed. I also am someone who really embraces uncomfortable and difficult conversations, because I believe that's where people can embrace each other and each other's humanity, and to start looking at what is really going on. And I've had very challenging conversations, mostly with people who happen to be white working class, and they're kind of very angry, and they have every right to be angry, and they're very agitated. And then I show up and they look really confused, because I present as a woman of color, I'm a visible Muslim, I wear a hijab, I could pass off as a stereotypical refugee or a migrant or someone who, you know, has come to, inverted commas, fleece the country, all those stereotypes. And when I show up, I find that overwhelmingly people want to talk. And specifically, what I find is white working class men want to talk. They want to have conversations. They want to have difficult, challenging conversations where they can talk about all the things they want to talk about, name the things. And sometimes these conversations become very fraught and very difficult. And at times they become highly charged and very racist. And then I have to say, stop, I'm not talking anymore to you. I'm not listening to you. You're being racist. If you stop being racist, I will listen to you and I will hear you out. And then that conversation kicks in. And every single time that that's happened, very different narrative has emerged to the one that we started off with in terms of why the conversation started. And what I've always found is that people, if they meet someone who's open with them, they will be open back. So I think there's a failing here of the political class, particularly those who have been elected to represent all of us, who allegedly are supposed to be doing this work. They're supposed to be out in their constituencies, listening to people, finding out what's going on, and trying to assist people. Now, just to be clear, there are plenty of good MPs out there who do that, and there's not enough of them who are doing that. There's not enough councillors who are doing that. And so I think that's a really important thing that needs to happen. And of course, we have to ask ourselves, why is a country that is still as rich as this country is, why do we have such horrific levels of child poverty, of deprivation? Why are we up there? You know, if you look at Europe, we're up there with being as unequal as Estonia, which is pretty staggering. And this has not improved over decades and decades. In fact, things have got worse and worse. You know, people have a right to dignified and decent housing. They have a right to an education system that works. They have a right to a health system that works. They have a right to public services that work. And people are exhausted. And when you're exhausted and you feel like your life is going backwards and your grandparents' generation had it much better than you, and you can't find a job and many other things, then you may well be vulnerable and susceptible to being manipulated. And you're not only going to be manipulated by people operating in the dark shadows of the internet, but you're also going to be manipulated by mainstream politicians who are given copious amounts of airtime to tell a story that is simply not true, a story that blames everything on immigration, everything on migrants, everything on people who look like me, rather than on the fact that this country's neoliberal policies have been a disaster for everyone. And, you know, the final point on this, Luke, is if you look at the data and the statistics on poverty and deprivation, disproportionately, British Muslim communities are represented in every single area of that data. And it's not because they're busy breeding and having too many children and all those things that the far right and others tell us. It's because things have not improved for them. They've always been at the lower realm of the economic ladder, and nothing has changed for them, because poverty and deprivation is deeply racialized and it's dominated by class. And disproportionately, the working class is made up of not just white people, but also people of color. And the fact that I even have to keep repeating that, and others do as well, is part of the myth that has been created around, you know, who is being impacted, who's got it bad, and why do they have it bad. But right now, I would say the working class in all its color, you know, black, brown, white, they're struggling and suffering together. And I also think it's really important in terms of the riots and the narrative around the riots, there is this kind of sneery, snidey, like, oh, look at these inverted commas, chavvy working class people on the streets causing havoc. Let's all laugh at them. You know, they're the uneducated ones. They're not like us. There's a lot of pearl clutching going on, particularly amongst white liberals, particularly middle class people. That lot over there have got nothing to do with us. It's such a classist and problematic response. It's shameful because the people who are being manipulated, they've become the foot soldiers of the riot, and many of them are ending up in prison now, as we know. They need to take responsibility for themselves. Why were they on the streets? Why were they shouting racist slogans? Why were they trying to burn down hotels, housing migrants? They need to take responsibility for all of that. And we collectively need to hold those people to account who are manipulating people and who have access to lots of money and networks, and also are running, you know, global media platforms, even though they don't want to call themselves media platforms. So they're the people at the top. They're the ones who need to be investigated, and the rest of us need to be challenging and looking at in disdain, in the same way as many people are looking at those people who are going for the criminal justice system with disdain.
Absolutely. And I think you put it across so well and with such responsibility. We've talked around it, but let's just talk about it a little bit more explicitly. There's obviously a strong, strong Islamophobic component to these riots that almost goes without saying. But it hasn't been an easy year to be a human being, but it's been a difficult, especially difficult for Muslim communities in light of what the appalling genocide in Gaza and communities of colour and Arab communities and secular Arab communities and so on, to have this kind of deep sense of attachment to what is happening there. And then to have this on top. Islamophobia is a kind, and indeed anti-Semitism, the way in which these kind of events are all linked together. I mean, I know after the start of the war in Gaza, there was a really strong uptick in Islamophobic attacks on the streets of the UK. There was also a rise in anti-Semitism, so it's kind of all connected. And you left the Labour Party over their response to the Gaza war, the Israeli war on Gaza. And I think it might be the first time that you've come on the podcast since you've left the party. So I just wanted to ask you around how you read the connection points between the two and the importance, I guess, of making those connection points.
Yeah, so I think it's important to make these connection points. And the organised far right have been on the streets in so-called counter-protests when people who believe in the rights of Palestinian people and want the genocide to end immediately are on the streets. And I don't think that's by accident. I think we need to look more closely at the synergy between both. And without a doubt, the way Islamophobia has additionally been mainstream, particularly by the previous government in relation to Palestine, the fact that then Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who says she doesn't have designs about becoming the Tory leader, but who knows if we can believe her on that front. But nonetheless, she called those marches hate marches. So when one of the most senior politicians in the country is labelling people who, by the way, those protests are very diverse and very multiracial. And of course, they have significant numbers of British Muslim people on the protests. However, it's a very diverse makeup of people at the protests. So for that to happen is absolutely appalling.
And also you'll remember, just, you know, actually a prelude in some ways to these fascist riots were the fascist attacks on the Palestinian demonstration in London, prompted by what Braverman said. So very kind of clear as day, direct link between the two in a way.
Absolutely. Clear as day, direct links, and yet denied from the top onwards. You know, the level of gaslighting, institutional gaslighting that continues to go on from the government and large sections of the media, and the way they frame these protests is just despicable. And what it does really is it puts anyone who is standing up for human rights, for international law, for the rights of refugees, for the rights of the Palestinian people, it puts us at risk. It makes us targets, not only for racists and the far right, but also targets often for the state apparatus in terms of being accused of being an extremist and things like that. You know, there's been very famous cases going through the courts of people of color holding placards. You know, one famous one is where a Muslim woman held a placard where she referred to Rishi Sunak and others as coconuts, which is a term that some people say is racist. But, you know, the policing of the placards and the policing of these protests, not just by the police, I'd like to add, but also by large sections of the media and the camaraderie and all of that, has been horrific. And meanwhile, before our very eyes, a genocide continues to unfold. The numbers of Palestinians who have been killed are at least 40,000. Every day you see images of children. I'm not going to be graphic on this podcast, but we all know what we're talking about. The way these children's bodies have been destroyed as Israel's missiles have hit Palestinian homes is horrific. And so on one level, you've got an international crisis going on in Gaza. People are shouting and screaming and demanding it comes to an end. And on the other hand, you've got people who are, you know, commentators, politicians, others shouting back saying, no, you're anti-Semitic, you're hateful, you're part of the hate mobs. It's astounding. It really is astounding. And I think it's very dangerous as well. The crisis in Gaza has caused huge fault lines in our country. There's been a 300% rise in recorded Islamophobia, the vast majority of which has been directed at British Muslim women, those who wear a clothing that identifies them as Muslim, so headscarves or other clothing. You know, it's horrifying. And equally, anti-Semitism has gone up as well. Huge spike in anti-Semitism. And I think the thing that we have to constantly remind people is that where you see anti-Semitism, you will see Islamophobia. It's one coin with two different faces, and the far right use both and they weaponize both. But right now, what the far right are doing is literally using the language of Suella Braverman and others to depict those of us who believe in the rights of Palestinians and indeed the rights of Jewish people and Israeli people as well to live in peace and security. We're being demonized and told that we are the problem. You know, I was speaking about this to my mom this morning. I've spent 20 years as an international aid worker. I have been so fortunate to travel most of the world, met incredible people in very challenging circumstances. I've seen a lot of things that most people could never dream of seeing, and I have never seen images like what we are seeing coming out of Gaza. It is incomprehensible that this has been allowed to go on and on and on. And the way you've got now Robert Jenrick and people like this, you know, and their absolute nonsense that they've been coming out around, you know, people who say Allahu Akbar, which means God is great, which is pretty much every Muslim in the world and many Christians and many other people of faith who will say it, you know, in a different language other than Arabic, they should be dealt with, is quite extraordinary.
It's the Muslim equivalent hallelujah for Christians, in effect, right?
Absolutely, you know.
I mean, it's just like they call themselves intelligent people, but I mean, they know it's not true is the kind of disturbing thing about it as well, right?
They know what they're doing. And the other side of the intelligence is the current government, which is the Labour government. So I resigned very early on. It was in October last year. I went to the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, Luke, and I was horrified. It was obviously a few days after the Hamas attacks and atrocities on Israelis. And obviously that's horrifying as well. And hostages have been taken and everything else that we know about. I went to the Labour Party conference and what I found was full erasure of Palestine. The word Palestine was not being mentioned in any rooms. Palestinians were being erased. I was absolutely disgusted and horrified. And so by the time, you know, I got ready to leave the Labour Party conference, Keir Starmer had given his now infamous interview to LBC Radio, where he was asked, the whole world's heard this now, where he was asked, is it okay for Israel to cut off water, electricity and gas? And he said, yes. I could not believe what I was hearing. You know, he's a human rights barrister, a former human rights barrister. He knows what international law is. He absolutely cannot pretend he doesn't. So for me, it was actually quite a straightforward thing, Luke. I came back home. I was heartbroken. I was heartbroken, obviously, by the events of October the 7th. I knew also what was in store for the Palestinians, which was making me even more heartbroken. already we've got a group of people in Israel who are suffering and devastated and traumatized. And then if you haven't been paying attention to this region, then perhaps you could be forgiven for not knowing what was going to happen. But the rest of us knew what was going to happen. So I came back, I wrote an email to the leader of the Oxford City Council, where I was a councillor, and also to my MP, Annalise Dodds, along with another colleague, happens to also be British Muslim. And they didn't respond to me. And then when he wrote back and said, hello, we'd like a response from you, we'd like to know why Keir Starmer is advocating collective punishment of Palestinians in Gaza, which is against international law, and is this Labour Party policy? By this point, Emily Thornberry had gone on a Newsnight and repeated the same horror. So he wrote to them, to the same people, and they responded with a copy and paste email about Hamas. We're asking you about the civilians of Gaza and upholding international law, and this is what you've come up with. It's just shameful. And so we both resigned together. And I have to tell you, Luke, I put my hard hat hijab on, because I was thinking, oh, the trolling and the racism and everything is now going to reach fever pitch. And I have to tell you, you know what? Overwhelmingly, it didn't. There was a very humane response to us, even from people who disagree with what we did in terms of resigning from the Labour Party. On the streets of my city, I met lots of people randomly stopping me and asking me if I was a councillor who resigned. And we had conversations on the street. Mostly 99% of these people, by the way, are residents of the city I live in, happen to be white people. There was one particular man who I'll never forget. It was the day I resigned. I took a deep breath and I stepped out of my home. I went to the supermarket and I came out, and there was a gentleman, an older gentleman, and he looked a bit confused. So I stopped and asked him if he was okay. And he was he looked a bit startled, and he said, yes, I am okay. So I said, are you sure? And then he said, oh, you're the councillor, aren't you? And I thought, I'm not really sure if I want to say yes to him, but I did. And we got talking, and he told me that he's Jewish, and he told me that he has family on the kibbutz. And he also told me that he'd seen a television interview that I'd given, a news interview about my resignation. And then we, two strangers, we basically started crying. We were sobbing because we were both talking about what's going to happen to the Palestinians next. And then his wife joined us. So three strangers sobbing outside a supermarket car park, two Jewish people and a Muslim person sobbing. And it was really powerful and moving and really heartbreaking as well. But it also gave me a lot of hope. And they were so kind and so gentle towards me. And I've never met them in my life before. I don't know who they are. And this was how they chose to meet me and how they chose to greet me. And it was so beautiful and humane. It was full of humanity. And I said, you know, one of the questions you asked me earlier on, I think this is what we need. We need more human contact. We need face-to-face contact. We need to be around each other to understand each other.
Wow, amazing. But this is the first Another Europe is Possible podcast since the election, and therefore the first under a Labour government, not a Labour in opposition, that we obviously have talked about quite a lot over the years on this podcast. So let's try and emphasise the positive. You've got a new campaign that you've been working on, Homes Not Hotels for Asylum Seekers, and it's run by an organisation called Conversation Over Borders. Let's just invite you to say a bit about that. What it says on the tin, I imagine. But also, how do you read this new Labour government? You were obviously a Labour Party member for many, many years. It's a mixed picture, and there's some pretty bad policies on immigration, I have to say. So your campaign is in conflict with the government, but there's also some positives as well. So what's your overall take?
Yeah, so thank you for, again, making space to talk about this in particular. So Conversation Over Borders is an organisation based in Brighton that works with refugees and asylum seekers across the country, particularly supporting them with their mental health, but also, you know, things like learning English and finding ways to become part of wider communities. And we also work with people who are housed in home office hotels. So I've been a volunteer with them for a year. I did a lot of work one-to-one with refugees and asylum seekers, focusing on their mental health. And right now I'm working with them again, but this time on campaigning, which is part of what I do. And the campaign that we're working on is called Safe Homes, Not Hotels. And the focus of this campaign is to call on the Home Office to close down those hotels that house migrants and refugees, because they are a target for the far right. They have become a rallying call for racist thugs, basically, to be out on the streets and attacking those places. But we also know that those places are not safe, they're not dignified, they're not humane. The contractors for the Home Office who run these hotels are making millions and millions of pounds every year from pretty much human misery. The situation in these hotels is not good at all. So what we're calling on is for the government to ensure that refugees and asylum seekers are put in homes which are part of the wider community, where they can actually have community around them, where they are not seen or demonized or devalued in the way that they are in the hotels. Now, there will be people listening to this thinking, well, actually, there's not enough homes for anyone in this country. The point is, there are empty homes, there are other bedsits, buildings that can become homes. And so that's what we're calling for. And we launched this campaign. We were planning to launch it regardless of the horrific far-right riots. However, on the back of the far-right riots, what's happened is people who are horrified by what's going on want to put their energy into something positive. So our open letter to Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, has been signed by more than 10,000 people now. That number is growing. And we've had a massive response from people. We've also got a campaign about welcoming migrants and refugees. And more than 3,000 people have written welcoming cards and notes, handwritten notes, that we are delivering to asylum hotels across the country, because it's really important for people who are in those horrendous hotels to know that there is a lot of solidarity and disgust at what they have had to deal with while they've been in those hotels. These are people, often some of the most vulnerable people in the world, in society, who are actually protected under international laws and refugee laws. And here they are in our country being subjected to this level of violence. It is disgusting. But the beautiful things are the hope and the fact that people, I think, are waking up to the fact that we have to be louder and we have to be more unapologetic in campaigning and standing up and demanding accountability from this government. Now, people will say, well, this government's in its honeymoon period. Yes, that's true. However, what they have done so far in relation to asylum and immigration doesn't really give you much confidence if you want to see the UK's asylum and immigration policy being aligned with international law, international conventions on the rights of refugees and asylum seekers, and also aligned with decency. So yes, they've scrapped Rwanda. Good. That was low-hanging fruit. I'm very, very glad that they've scrapped that. They've scrapped the barge, the BB Stockholm. Very good. Again, low-hanging fruit. However, the announcement from the Home Office just this week about them wanting to have a record number of people returned, it's horrifying. And the fact that the entire response is about the securitization of this country and the further securitization of Europe, Fortress Europe, this is not a response. And I think one of the kind of pushbacks that we're seeing is that people are starting to wake up and understand this. And I do really think that the riots on the street, there's horrific racist, Islamophobic, anti-refugee migrant riots have contributed to people waking up, because there are plenty of decent people in our country. And I think often decent people think, oh, it's okay, I'll keep quiet because someone else can speak, or someone else can protest, or someone else can demand accountability. And I think people are now understanding that that's not possible. We have a long journey ahead of us in relation to better accountability from Yvette Cooper and the Home Office. Yes, they are not the same as the previous government, thankfully. However, I think that those of us on the left and those of us who have spent last 15, 20 years trying to hold the Tories to account need to apply the same ethics to the Labour government as well.
That concludes this episode of the Another Europe is Possible podcast. There's no extra time this week, as we thought we'd put the whole episode of the podcast out in full. We'd still urge you to join the campaign and support our work. Members of Another Europe get access to extra podcast material as a benefit of supporting the campaign. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. See you next time.